my God, why have you forsaken me? And then as you look through the description of his suffering, do you see what does it describe in verse 6? Just holler it out. Psalm 22. Scorned by mankind. Verse 7. He's mocked. In fact, in verse 8, he's mocked for trusting in God. In verse 14, poured out like water, bones out of joint. Verse 15, he's thirsty. Verse 16, his hands and feet are pierced. Verse 18, they do what? They divide my garments, and for my clothing they cast lots. And this is another example of category. Of David is a category of a righteous sufferer. But there is an ultimate righteous sufferer, and that's Jesus. All right, go over to Psalm 69. We also took some time in that class. You can find it on YouTube, and went through Psalm 69. I think you may remember a statement from Psalm 69 in John's gospel. It's the statement John quotes when he explains what Jesus does in the temple. It's Psalm 69 and verse 9. For zeal for your house has consumed me. Remember that from John's gospel? But then in the course of this, notice what he says about his suffering in verse 21. Psalm 69, 21. They gave me poison for food, and for my thirst they gave me what? Sour wine to drink. So all of these Old Testament allusions are a way of saying to us, what is happening here in Luke 23 is exactly what God has planned would happen. All of these details exactly as he foretold them. Okay, let's go back to Luke 23 now, and we're going to start at verse 39, but I'll just pause here. Any questions or comments you have? Very good. Listen at John Jennings back there. Ralph, he might get the gold star today's class here. Now, but did I put that in the notes, though? Let me just double check and see if you're just, if I could read my notes here. So, no, I think that's very perceptive. If y'all heard what John, didn't hear what John said, we've already heard somebody else in this gospel say, if you are the Son of God, do this, that, or the other. And it's Satan back at the temptation. So, no, I think you're very perceptive to catch that. That's excellent. Matter of fact, I meant to put it into the notes, but I didn't. So there you go. John bailing me out, as usual. Very good. All right, let's look here at verse 39. Boy, this story, it gets to me. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him. And he's joining in with everybody else. Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him, saying, do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? You know, it's an interesting thing about human psychology. That when people are in collective suffering, they will either become more spiteful, more bitter toward everybody. But then there are some who has the opposite effect on them. And he says, do you not fear God, verse 40, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation, and we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And you just want to know, how do you know who Jesus is? How do you know he has a kingdom to come into? I'm going to preach about the thief here in a few weeks as I kind of talk about different people who were there, like Simon. So I don't want to say too much, but it is astonishing. Think about this. One of the commentators I read put this together. I hadn't thought about it like this before. There are people who believe Jesus is the Messiah. Peter, the apostles, other followers, who believe that it is inconsistent with him to be the Messiah and to be crucified. There are people who think he should be crucified, but can't be the Messiah. That's like the chief priest and so forth. This man right here is the first person to put together the fact Jesus can be king and crucified. He's the first one who gets it, because he knows he's being crucified, and he knows he's being crucified unjustly, and he knows he's the king. And he knows that the crucifixion is not going to be the end of his kingship, because he says, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." That's amazing. So I got a few weeks maybe to figure out how in the world did he come to know this, and I probably won't. But it's astonishing. And it's powerful. And so Jesus says to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." All right, yeah, Darren. Right. That's right. If you're these people's king, well, how come they want you to be put to death so much? Which just makes this man's faith just astonishing. Just makes it astonishing. Yeah, John and then Dave. Yeah. John is trying, he's trying to steal my talk I'm trying to put together here. He's filling in the details. No. That's exactly right. I think you're on the right path. And what John said, I especially want to make sure everybody heard, is coming face to face with death has a way of clarifying things. Now, it also has a way of embittering. You see both of those, right, in these two things. That's a great comment, John. Yeah, Dave.
He took half of it.
Excellent. Yeah.
We have to remember that. There are probably people here who have done things like this man. And we have to remember that. He didn't come to this conclusion all at once. He probably heard and was convicted, and finally being face to face and next to him, understood.
Yeah, look at these people. They're just, I throw out an idea here and they're already glomming onto it here.
Right.
No. Somebody record, write this down for me. No, I think those are excellent. Those are excellent comments, and it's definitely the way for us to think about. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about Simon is, some time ago I read somewhere, I just don't remember where, that one great way to meditate on the Bible is in stories, pick characters, and imagine you're them, and try to see things from their point of view. This is what I was trying to do this morning, with Simon. And this thief, just think about that. Yeah. But I'm sorry. Yeah, Tommy. Tommy's asking a very insightful question. Were Roman citizens subject to crucifixion? They were not. That's the reason, you might remember in the book of Acts, when Paul gets mistreated, he can bring up his Roman citizenship. And they realize he has certain rights. And it's the reason that someone like Paul, according to historical tradition, was beheaded, whereas Peter was crucified. Yeah, great question. Yeah. Yeah.
There's one big parallel in the entire text. The world and the leaders of the world who were in charge of this.
Yeah, Kyle's just making the point that, you know, not many people come off good in this account. That's just the reality of it. And all of us, when we come face to face with the cross, there's somebody said that the ground at the foot of the cross is level. We're all on the same level there, and we need to see that. And once we start to think we're better than, and we've got it all figured out, like some of the leaders did, then we're in big trouble for sure. All right, let's go here to verse 44. It was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. So the sixth hour would be something like noon, and the ninth hour would be somewhere around approximately 3 o'clock by their way of counting time. Let's remember, though, that darkness has symbolic significance. In fact, back when they came to arrest Jesus in chapter 22 and in verse 53, Jesus says at the end of that verse, "This is your hour and the power of darkness." So there's a lot going on here with the reference to the darkness that comes over as the sun's light fails. Also, highly symbolic in its significance is the detail in verse 45 that the curtain of the temple was torn in two, the veil that separates the Holy of Holies from everywhere else. What do you think that would symbolize? Yeah, there's a change. The temple is no longer that which will be the centerpiece of the presence of God and the way to have access to God. Instead of everyone having to go to Jerusalem, Acts 1, you shall be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. It's going to radiate out, is the idea. And God is now accessible. In fact, I have a whole series of lessons on the imagery of the temple that I stole from my mentor, Phil Roberts, and then just, you know, fluffed up a little bit. But Jesus in John 2, destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I will raise it up. You know, he himself becomes the temple. Verse 46, then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit," which is a prayer from Psalm 31. "And having said this, he breathed his last." And then we have another one of these characters. There's so many interesting characters around the cross. Centurion. And you know, overall, in the Gospel of Luke and in the book of Acts, centurions are treated somewhat favorably. It was the centurion servant who gets healed. In the book of Acts, it's a centurion who saves Paul from nearly being murdered in the temple, guards him on his way. Cornelius was a centurion. It's just kind of interesting. And I'm assuming that this centurion, a commander of 100, is someone who was maybe supervising what's taking place here. And it says that when he saw what had taken place, he praised God, saying, "Certainly this man was innocent." And now we want to know the same thing. We want to know about the thief. What's his backstory? How did he come to learn all this? Notice also, here's another example of Luke making the point that we should not assume every Jewish person there was in favor of the execution of Jesus, or is no longer in favor of it now, because it says in verse 48, "And all the crowds that had assembled for this spectacle, when they saw what had taken place, returned home beating their breasts." There is something about the way Jesus died, the obvious, manifest way in which it's clear this was an innocent man who should not have been put to death, that affects people so much that although they came to celebrate, once it happens, their mood completely changes. There's a story in church history, there's versions of this story, about the way the gladiator contests came to an end in Rome. And the story is that there was a Christian, I think his name was Telemachus, who rushed into the arena and tried to intervene and stop these soldiers from trying to kill each other for the grisly entertainment of the crowd. And one of them stabbed him and murdered him. And at that point, the crowd fell silent, walked out of the arena, and that was the end of those games. It preaches good. I don't know if that's exactly what happened. But if it is like that, it would be another example of this kind of thing where there was something about the solemnity of what just happened, the obvious injustice of it. Something sacred has happened here. And they go away. Yeah, Dean? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes. In addition to the veil and the darkness, Matthew mentions the tombs opening and the earthquake happening. Yes. All right, verse 49, all his acquaintances and the women who had followed him from Galilee were doing what? Standing at a distance. By the way, who else is that phrase used of? Who else has stood at a distance so far? Peter at the trial. That's exactly right. So there's a little bit of good here. Hey, at least they're there, but also there's some standoffishness here. All right, verse 50. I guess you could say this whole chapter is one example after another of surprising faith. Surprising who doesn't have it, but surprising who does. So, you know, the thief on the cross, the centurion, and now a member of the Sanhedrin council. There was a man named Joseph from the Jewish town of Arimathea. He was a member of the council, a good and righteous man who had not consented to their decision and action. He was looking for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then he took it down and wrapped it in a linen shroud and laid it in a tomb cut in stone where no one had yet been laid. So the kind of tomb that's being described here is this kind of tomb, which is basically cut into the side of a hill like a cave and would have a gutter and then a rolling stone that could be rolled over down into the gutter to seal it off. If you ever went to Israel, I know some of you have taken a tour, they always stop at this place, and if you want to go in, you can. I'm not going into anything like that, but other people on our tour did kind of go in and stoop in. So Joseph here, who would believe it? Someone on the Sanhedrin, willing to identify so closely with Jesus that he's willing to take him and bury him in his own tomb. And of course, these details like being wrapped in linen, we understand the Jewish burial practices were not to embalm, but to wrap in linen and then to anoint with spices to cover the smell of decomposition. Verse 54 says, it was the day of preparation and the Sabbath was beginning. The women who had come with him from Galilee followed him and saw the tomb and how his body was laid and returned to prepare the spices and ointment, but they rest on the Sabbath according to the commandment. It's interesting, in Luke's gospel, Jesus' birth and his death makes a specific point that those who loved him were scrupulous to follow the law. His parents, the presentation at the temple, the offering of the turtle dove and pigeons for the poor, and now these who were going to provide for his burial. All right, let's keep going. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, soon as they could, they went to the tomb taking the spices they had prepared. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men stood by them in dazzling apparel. And as they were frightened and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, men who, by the way, later are described for us in verse 23 as angels, why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise? And they remembered his words. And returning from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles, and the apostles were thrilled to get the news of the empty tomb from these dear sisters. No. It says these words seemed to them what? It's hysterical talk from women. Now, this obviously does not speak well to the apostles and the others. It was very typical in the first century for the testimony of women to be considered inauthentic, illegitimate. And that's the way they respond here. But, you know, we've seen this time and again in the Gospel of Luke. Luke takes special interest in the women that Jesus encounters and the women that follow Jesus. And once again, he does here. However, verse 12 ends with someone deciding, I think I'll go check things out for myself. And who is that? Now, do you remember? Just a couple days earlier, Jesus said to him, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all y'all, remember? Sift all of you like wheat. But when the time comes and you're converted, you go strengthen your brothers. So now we're seeing here the start of that turn to take place. As Peter goes and realizes, they were right. The tomb is empty. All right. Well, one more to go. We'll finish on Wednesday night, Lord willing.